$1,500 for those that are on 24-hour time.
Hit it.
And the January 27th work planning commission work session is now in session. So first order of business is we kind of do a roll call. So Dustin Capri.
Present.
I didn't forget him. Commissioner Updike.
Here.
Commissioner East.
Here.
Commissioner Berman.
Here.
Commissioner and Mayor Hanselman.
He's here as well.
And Commissioner Baer.
Here.
As well as Commissioner Brannigan. Okay. And we have one person on the Zoom.
That is correct. We have Brett Shipton on the Zoom.
Okay. Hello, Brett. Can we see you?
Incognito.
He's incognito. Okay.
You can see me if I can figure out my camera. Hold on.
Oh, there he is.
There
he is.
Here I am.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good evening.
Good evening. Got a nice brown hoodie on. Okay.
Yeah.
Warm.
Warm, yeah. Maybe he's in Michigan.
Yeah.
Okay, new business. First order of the new business. There is no 1A, so there must be a secret 1A. No?
Yeah. That's called an order.
Oh, that was a call to order, okay. So we have 2A. A request by Columbia West Engineering. The city amend its geologic hazard code to allow the geologic report to be prepared by geotechnical engineers. Mr. Director.
Thank you, Derek Tokos, Community Development Director. As you noted, you have in your packet actually a letter from Brett Shipton, Columbia West Engineering, asking that the Planning Commission consider amending its geologic hazards code to allow geotechnical engineers to prepare geologic reports. Currently, the way the code is structured, only a certified engineering geologist can prepare the report. Geotechnical engineers can be involved, but they would be involved as the engineer of record for doing designs of anything that requires engineering remediation, typically like a retaining wall or something of that nature. And so that engineering analysis would be paired with the geologic report, and both would stamp off on it if you had engineering remediation as part of a geologic hazards report and proposed development of property. The reasoning, and Brett's here, and I would encourage him to share his thoughts here in just a moment, but as you noted in the letter, Brett's reasoning is that certain geotechnical engineers with requisite qualifications, which are outlined in his letter, are authorized by the Oregon State Board of Geologists Examiners to mentor expiring certified engineering geologists. And his reasoning is that, look, if they can mentor aspiring certified engineering geologists, they ought to be able to just go ahead and prepare these reports. I included a couple of the sections of the geologic hazards codes that would be at issue, so you had a chance to take a look at it. I also had shared with you, I did not share this with Brett, but I'm sure is aware of this document. But I did pass along earlier today that document that Dogami and DLCD put together, Landslide Hazards Guide for Oregon Communities. It was 2019. Pages 27 to 30 actually had brief little paragraphs where they explained the differences between the different certifications: registered geologist, certified engineering geologist, and geotechnical engineers. As you know, the Planning Commission, by motion, can initiate amendments to the zoning ordinance. That would be required to expand the scope of who's qualified to do geologic reports. If you're inclined to go down that path, it would also be appropriate to look at, okay, well, what standards are these reports to be drafted to? Currently, It's guidelines that are put out by the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners, if I can get that out of my mouth. That's a different body than what geotechnical engineers report to. They're licensed by a different body. So those are the two things in play. Certainly, if geotechnical engineers are authorized to prepare these reports, that expands the scope of professionals out there that people can hire, which would make it easier for folks to be able to find someone who can assist them on a project. And across, you know, on balance, might actually make it a little bit cheaper for folks. It's not an inexpensive endeavor when you're looking to develop on potentially unstable ground. That's about all I have at this point. I think Mr. Shipton, you know, was kind enough to join us tonight. He may have some additional thoughts he'd like to share with you.
Can I ask before we get to the testimony?
Yeah.
Well, it's not really testimony. It's just comments. What was the reason we didn't do this originally? I remember the discussions, but I don't remember why it was.
The reasoning at the time we did this code, this was 2011. The reasoning at that time was that certified engineering geologists were best positioned to do this type of report. They look at these issues in a little bit broader detail than some of the other licensed experts. Geotechnical engineers were viewed as being more structural oriented, not necessarily looking at the larger geologic issues on a property and how that really more focused on ensuring that a house or a wall or another structure is designed such that it's capable of withstanding, you know, or it's not going to be at significant risk of failure in that particular area, but not looking at the underlying geology on a broader scale. And so certified engineering geologists were identified as the appropriate body at the time to prepare the reports. And the reports are to be prepared up to the standards that are set out by the Oregon State Board of Geologist Examiners, which is the body they report to or are beholden to. So as you saw in the code, you know, there was specific thought given to this, that there, you know, geotechnical engineers are referenced in the code that was drafted at that time as being you know, appropriate to weigh in relative to engineered solutions, but not for preparing the reports themselves. I mean, I'm from my perspective, you know, it's been some time since we've looked at this issue. I'm not sure, Brett may have some thoughts on this, whether or not this mentoring program was even in place at that time. Things change and evolve, and it's certainly worth a look to see if you know, we ought to be making some adjustments here. I think we would also want to pull in DOGAMI, Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, who we worked with very closely when we did this last code update to get their thoughts and on the matter as well. So,
thank you.
I can jump in if you need me to kind of feed my case here, but you know, so CEGs, the certified engineer geologists, are, I mean, there are fewer and fewer of them, and they're very hard to come by. And the reason I'm doing this is I was working on a project in the city of Newport, and the person that was developing this property could not find somebody that wanted to work on it. He called me. I do know a certified engineering geologist that I'd worked with in my prior history. I got him involved, but I had to twist his arm to get in there. And I think it's kind of a little bit, I don't know, unfair that we are allowed to mentor them, and because they have to apply for this license, right? And working on a geotechnical engineer counts for experience for them. So we are mentoring them. And then once they do take this exam and become a CEG, they can work in areas that we can't. This is one of the only jurisdictions that has this. The city of Oregon City has many geologic hazards, and they allow geotechnical engineers to do similar work as CEGs. I don't know why the city of Newport has it. There must be some reason back in the day. Maybe it must be prior to the geotechnical engineering license that was established, but I mean, it is kind of an anomaly that that this one jurisdiction has that requirement.
You know roughly how many jurisdictions are on either side of this question?
I've worked in the city of Portland, I've worked in the city of Oregon City, I've worked in the city of Beaverton. I've never actually run into this other than this time in the city of Newport. There might be other jurisdictions, but none that I've worked in.
Dustin, being the architect.
I have endless opinions about this. I agree. Like, we work in Tillamook County, we work in up and down the coast, and Newport's the only one that has the CEG requirement. So, I mean, it's something I've grown accustomed to, where I'm like, oh, we can only use a CEG, but to their point, you know, there's not a lot of CEGs. I won't pretend to, like, understand the educational background that goes into it, but I've always had it, like, rudimentarily explained to me that a CEG is a dirt person, whereas a geotechnical engineer is someone like with more of a background in construction, trying to figure out how to mitigate the soil condition for construction versus someone who has a broader study of soils, which in my experience as an architect, I mean, we work with a lot of great CEGs, so I don't want to put down any of our CEG colleagues, but they've sort of evolved their business to cater to construction, whereas, like, if that is your background, it's actually more helpful to have someone who's thinking not just about, like, soil conditions and describing a hazard, but also, like, specifically how to mitigate that. And I think both can do it well, and we work with both all the time, you know, up and down the coast, just not in the city of Newport. And with regards to, like, the report, I think it'd be interesting if you reach out to Director Absher in Tillamook County. I think they have a really nice code section on this where they outline, like, specifically what the report needs to entail. And so, like, they'll kick back GHR reports, or they have, like, a separate geohazard report permit process. And they'll kick back the reports all the time, whether CEG did it or a geotechnical engineer, based on them not meeting the criteria that's outlined in the code for the report. So it's a nice way to sort of tailor it, because to Derek's point, like, every CEG or certified engineering geologist or geotechnical engineer has different, like, strategies and things they include. So if the city adopts some sort of, like, baseline language for what the reports need to include, that keeps everyone sort of to that same standard for development.
Okay.
That's my thought.
I would emphasize that one of the Brad's points here, though, too, is that it's not all geotechnical engineers he's talking about. It's talking about those with specific expertise that is, you know, positions them such that the State Board of Geologist Examiners, which provides oversight to the CEGs, said, hey, they've got enough experience to mentor aspiring CEGs. So one thing, if we do move forward and we're looking at that, is how do we know somebody has that? Is that something that the State Board of Geologist Examiners maintains a list of geotechnical engineers that are qualified to serve as mentors? I those are questions I have. And, you know, whether or not we want to retool the report standards since they're tailored to CEGs.
I have a question there. I think I read where if you're a certified geotechnical engineer, I guess a certified one, that you have liability if by signing off and stamping it and the report and everything, if something goes wrong, you're liable. Whereas the geotechnical is not liable. Is that true?
I don't think so. No, I think they're all liable as professionals.
I can jump in there, yeah. But by putting our stamp on a report, it means we're liable for the whole kit and caboodle, the geology. So we are liable for everything if we did that. And the requirements are quite stringent. So the Board of Geologists say you have to have 5 years experience, you have to be a licensed geotechnical engineer, and you have to have a you have to demonstrate this through the through the work. So the what geotechnical engineers are, they're civil engineers, but they go on to do extra work in with soil and geology. And so we have the coursework that's necessary. We have the experience that's necessary. So we kind of work where structures interact with the soil and the geology. But in short, yes, we're liable. If something goes wrong, it's all on us.
I have a question, too. Aren't all GEs a PE? You become a PE.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, you have to be a PE, and then after that, you can take the GE exam to become a geotechnical engineer.
So at the end of the day, you're all professional engineers, and then you go into a subspecialty of becoming a geotechnical engineer. So your background is in engineering, and then you have that specialty in geotechnical engineering.
That's correct. Yes, yes. You take an extra exam. It's similar to the geologist. You have a geology, and they once they are a licensed geologist, they can take the certified engineering geology exam.
So every CEG is an RG.
They say they need to be, yeah, I believe that's correct. You need to have your RG, and then you can become a CEG.
Well, what kind of motion do we need, Derek?
I just need to know if there's general consensus. You want to move this into a potential legislative update. Then we'll work on putting together some potential amendments for a discussion at an upcoming work session. You wouldn't initiate the formal legislative process till you had a product you were comfortable moving forward with, and we'll engage, and get feedback from Dogami and others as part of this process. This strikes me though as something that's fairly narrowly tailored, not quite like the full code update previously. I don't see a need for broad public engagement when you're dealing with just a narrow technical issue such as this.
So that includes the questions you had in the memorandum?
Yeah.
Which were all valid and good questions, so that would all be part of it. Okay.
I'm a little nervous about the process of, like, trying to qualify them, because I think, like, a lot of the firms that, like, the city of Newport even works with, you guys have contracts with Foundation Engineering, right? And half of their staff are GEs, and then they have, like, one or two CEGs, right? And that's what, like, qualifies the stamp at the end, but, like, most of their staff are just geotechnical engineers with a PE background.
Yeah, a lot of the reports we get are stamped by both a CEG and a geotechnical engineer.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, like,
because a lot of what we have is not just the assessment of the, the conditions of the site, but there's an engineered solution typically involved in with the construction, and so you end up getting both. But, I'd be reaching out to the State Board of Geologists Examiners and see if they maintain a list of geotechnical engineers who they've vetted as mentors, because that'd be the easy way for us to approach that. Say, hey, look, okay, if you're on their list, we'll accept it. If not, no. Versus us having to try to confirm somebody's qualified for doing a report.
Aren't they already qualified, though, by being geotechnical engineers in theory?
Well, that's not what, we can talk about that and work through that since we're opening the door on this, but as Brett framed it, it really is, his argument is that, hey, look, the Oregon State Board of Geology Examiners says that a subset of geotechnical engineers with certain qualifications are suitable for mentoring aspiring CEGs, and it's those folks that should be eligible for doing the reports.
Brett, I presume you're one of those GEs?
I am, yeah. I have a geotechnical engineering license, and I have 20 years of geotechnical engineering experience. I only require 5 to be that person to mentor the aspiring CEGs.
Is that the criteria, or what did you have to do to get on that list?
From what I've read in their code is a geotechnical engineering license plus 5 years of experience.
Okay. Do you have to apply to get on that list, or did it automatically happen when you were working for 5 years?
It just automatically happened. Yeah. So when I work, say, for the city of Oregon City, they see I'm a geotechnical engineer, and they don't really question how many years I have, but I have more than enough. And they do have this document that you do have to follow. It's the kind of a steps you have to look at these kind of issues. You have to look at these geologic maps. You have to look at all the landslide hazards, the map landslides, and the historical landslides that have occurred in the area. So it's not just like willy nilly that anybody can do this work. It's just as if you gain that experience, then you're allowed to.
And the main motivation here is availability, and is cost also a factor?
Yeah, I think availability is definitely an issue. I don't think, I'm not even aware of new CEGs coming into the practice. The rate of retirement and the new people is just diminishing the pool of CEGs. And I'm assuming that the lack of competition kind of drives the cost up too.
Derek, if there isn't a readily available list, is an option just self-certification?
Potentially. We'd have to talk through it. Right. See how we want to approach it.
Okay. One of the things we could do is we could add our resume to our kind of our report and say, get our license, and this is when we were licensed, and get our resume showing that we have this experience. I mean, that's another way of doing it.
Any other questions? Otherwise, what we're doing is there a consensus for Derek to go out and put something together that we could take a look at in another work session? So all in favor of, is there anybody opposed to not having Derek do that?
No, I'd appreciate if he'd bring some more information back.
Okay.
I'm always questioning mentoring, length of time, thoroughness, that kind of thing, and who's doing the mentoring. Those are always those catchy words. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case of these kinds of issues in a geological interesting area, you want the most expertise that's required. I think we should identify what the best qualifications for doing these reports are.
Okay. You okay with it, Robert?
Man. Yep. Let's move forward.
Yep. I'm okay. Okay. We have a consensus to move forward. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate your consideration.
Okay. Next time.
I'll find out when you go to the next item. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Next item is 2B. Scope of the zoning ordinance housekeeping amendment package. Mr. Director.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and share the memo just to make sure I touch on each of the items. From time to time, it's appropriate to do a housekeeping package because we do so many code amendments. You don't always get everything cross-referenced and cleaned up the way you want to. By and large, a housekeeping, when we say housekeeping, that means housekeeping, and we're not talking about making major substantive changes to the code. So if you see anything in here you feel is outside the scope of housekeeping, please flag it. I tried to look at it that lens. This is not in something where there would be some significant change that would impact folks on the ground. That's not what this is about. This is really about readability and workability of the code and making sure things are synced up the way they were intended to be synced up. So I outlined some of the areas that appear to need some attention when I went through that. Certainly the definitions, there's still some definite, there are likely a few terms in here that probably can be deleted because they're not or no longer used elsewhere in the code. There are a few areas where we still have references to standard industrial classifications or SIC codes. That used to be how the city organized its zoning code until we took it to use classifications or groupings of uses. So there's still a few of those hanging out in the code, I noticed, that can go away. And it appears that there are some areas where we can consolidate definitions or like-type definitions where they're, like, say, in one chapter, but they're also in the definitions. We can just get them all consolidated into the definition section. Establishment of a zoning map. So the city no longer maintains an official paper map with a stamp on it. What we do is it's a compilation of ordinances that have been approved and adopted by the city council with a recommendation from the planning commission. So this section is just out of date and needs to be updated to reflect current modern practices with respect to how we maintain our zoning information. No changes would be made to any zoning boundaries as part of this, just clarifying how that information is managed. There is also some room to add some clarifying language with respect to Title IX and how permitting is handled in public rights of way and what land use rules apply within rights of way. It's not as clear as it could be, and so that's one piece that we touch as well. When we get to required yards, one thing that the city has done, and it's not clearly articulated in here, is we allow or have it traditionally allowed for what we call no-build easements in certain circumstances, so that if you can obtain a no-build easement, that would then basically effectively move your property line for purposes of application of a setback. So if you've got an eave of a building that's getting too close to your property line, for example, and wouldn't meet the setback, but if you could pick up a no-build easement off your neighbor, we would allow that to suffice and basically move your how we would measure the setback. We really should build that into the code to align with what the city's traditionally done.
This also relate to the undeveloped right-of-way things that we've been approving?
Undeveloped right-of-way? I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Setbacks from the property line versus from the reasonable...
Oh, relative to like measuring a driveway distance and stuff like that? Not exactly. No, it's a little bit different. This really has more to do with structural development. So your most common one would be like a eave that's getting too close to a side lot line or a building that maybe in some cases it's an existing non-conforming situation someone's struggling with as well. So minimum lot size under 1412. We put in language elsewhere in the code that allows modest density increases and lot sizes to go below minimums in certain circumstances if it means more housing. It was part of the housing package we approved. It didn't get the cross-references into 1412, so that language is a little bit confusing as it reads right now, and it needs to be synced up with that prior work from Ordinance 2222. Density limits fits that. We do have a hiccup on clear vision areas with respect to child care. Certified child care centers have to have a 4-foot fence height per administrative rule. We only allow a 3-foot fence height in front yards, so that's one to take a look at. I don't view that as a major policy issue, but you know it basically means that you can't have a child care center with any outside play area in a front yard area. And I don't know that was ever our intent.
When that's being looked at, would it be possible just to allow 4-foot fences in the front yard?
The conversation here would be to allow it for child care centers only.
I'm just wondering everywhere, though. 3-foot fence is hard. It's kind of like a strange height.
I think it'd be, well, it's intentional because vehicles don't always sit up that high. 4 foot's pushing it.
Yeah, but you're set back from the right-of-way. I mean, you're set back from the edge of the road with most property lines.
Allowing it throughout the city, I think, is a bigger step, certainly, than allowing it in the narrow context of childcare facilities that have to have it for them to operate. So I think I'd want to start with the childcare facilities. We've got some references to the News Times in the code. Need to fix that. Got some references to the subdivision code as it used to be under... Chapter 1305, those need to be fixed. just more bad sites. We do have a chapter that I think we need to take a look at. It's 14.4.1 for assisted living facilities in R2 zones. I need to take a look at that for compliance with existing state law, and determine, you know, really if that really has a place, or it's already, all of those rules are really already effectively addressed elsewhere versus it being singled out for its own chapter. Because we have assisted living fits under the normal housing program. So that's one, that's an old legacy chapter that probably needs some attention. 14.4.2 probably does as well. The state tax incentive structure for preserving open space has evolved over time and may not be the kind of incentive that really warrants an overlay. Or, we can leave the overlay in place, but just recognize that it's never going to get used. So that's worth a look too. Let's see here. And some bad references in a couple other, in 1447. The general theme throughout is just correcting old citations, verifying that our statutory and administrative rule cites are still accurate. The legislature's over the last few sessions has changed a whole lot of statutory references. There are likely a few of them that we're citing to old statute references that are no longer the most current ones. We need to pick that up. That's not the kind of thing that somebody like Muni Codes, who's working on, they're not going to pick up that kind of stuff. That's too technically specific for them.
How are they doing on that?
I've got a check-in meeting with our city manager's office on that, who's managing that project in early February. I'll let you know once we have that. Any discrepancies in terms of our procedural requirements, and then, you know, just working through to make sure that I know of at least, I think, one or two spots where we have some sentence structure issues that we probably want to fix. So,
are these things that have come up, like, as applicants or people have come and talked to you, and you're like, shoot, and you just keep a running list,
Keep a running list, but I didn't want to go through all of the gory details. I want to really kind of hit kind of the higher levels for each of these. So, it'd come back as very specific amendments with why we're doing everything. Does this seem like a kind of a reasonable scope for this kind of? Is there anything that any of you have noticed in the code that I should be thinking of that I didn't list here?
You'll find something,
Bob. I trust you.
No, we've had some instances in the past where references to 1 month versus references to 30 days. You might watch out for that.
Yeah. Now, that is something that Muni Code is being paid to do, is consistency of terminology and like that, and where, say, you're capitalizing or not capitalizing certain terms, like city manager or something. So they'll be doing a lot of that stuff. But they wouldn't pick up if ORS 197, 763 changed to a different statutory site.
What do you need from us?
This was an opportunity just for you to take a look. As I've outlined, is this reasonable? If it looks reasonable, I'm going to bring back a more detailed package for you to look at.
And we'll all read the entire municipal code in the meantime.
You're not obligated to. I really, again, you know, one of the things with this is an eye towards, is there anything in there that looks controversial or a potential bigger issue that should be carved out and not part of a housekeeping is supposed to be boring. It's supposed to be a boring package, not a, you know.
Congratulations. I thought it was boring.
Success.
Derek, a long time ago, and I don't know if this is something, but there is a portion of a ordinance about cutting trees on the slope at the bluff, at the beach, like my property. And there's a piece of language in there that absolutely made no sense. And at the time I asked you about how does that fit with the concept of trees on a slope, and you were a bit befuddled by it too. I don't know which section it's in. Would that be something? It was just like the last sentence or two that made absolutely no sense. And it seemed to me that deserves attention.
Well, you need to find it.
Yeah, I mean,
if it's tree removal, generally, well, if it's something I'm tackling here in Chapter 14, it would be under the geologic code. We can take a look at that.
Well, it's about taking trees greater than 8 inches in diameter off the slope that leads to the beach.
Yep. Or the beach.
Maybe it's just on slopes, but it pertained to my situation.
Got it.
And the neighbor cutting down much larger trees.
Okay.
That kind of a thing. So.
It'd be in the geo.
And it seemed like he got it was permitted because of the last two sentences, which you couldn't even understand the continuity between the two possible issues. But anyway, okay. It sounds like I'll have to hunt for a.
I'll take a look at the geo exemptions. That's probably where it's at.
It's just some language that I thought, if we're doing this.
What type of tree was it he cut down?
One was a shore pine, and the other, I believe, was a spruce.
Shore pine. That's a nuisance tree, that shore pine.
Yeah. Well, they were, 12 and 15 inches in diameter.
That's a big shore pine.
And done by people that never looked to the ordinance.
Of course.
I'm done.
Okay. We've got what I need at this point.
Okay, next on the list is item 2C, reviewing draft nuisance / property maintenance code changes, which is a council goal.
Yeah, it's a council goal. This is just an update, really, and information for you, so you're aware of this is going to be put in ordinance format for presentation and potential adoption by the council within the next month or so. So this is well along in the process. The issue here is that the city council wanted some additional teeth in the nuisance code, particularly as it relates to buildings or structures that are not being properly maintained or well-maintained, but have not deteriorated to the point where they are a dangerous building that would then trigger action by our building official. So when it's under the nuisance code, just context, nuisance code is implemented by community service officers in our police department. A nuisance, and then the citations, should they get to that, go through the municipal court. If it gets to be a dangerous building, that's when our building official steps in. A dangerous building typically then would lead to, say, would be noticed, so you could not occupy the structure until the repairs are made. That would be a dangerous building. Buildings that are at risk of falling down. We do have that come up from time to time. Some of the common example along the bayfront in particular, we've had a couple down there where, the pile had failed and the floors were falling out, and that's where we step in. Different process there. We do have the ability there to compel abatement, a little bit stronger terms than we do under the nuisance code. Again, council wanted some additional tools in here for dealing with just buildings that, are in a state of disrepair but not dangerous yet. They got holes in the walls. You got a significant amount of peeling paint. The gutters aren't being maintained such that they're causing a lot of dry rot. They're on a path towards being a dangerous building if it's not taken care of at some point in time. Council's really clear. They wanted these as additional tools. This is still a complaint-driven system, and the CSOs would focus on your more egregious circumstances where you have this. We're not talking about a small amount of peeling paint on the frame of a door on a particular house. They're going to be looking, drag that per se. Hey, you've got to fix that. They're going to be focusing more on the egregious stuff. We're not looking at adding additional staff here, so this would be handled by the existing CSOs. We've got two of them. And deal with a lot of things other than buildings too. Council's comfortable with the structure of this. One thing they did ask for was to add some nuisance lighting language in, which I put together. It's in here. Shared that with our police chief since he works with the CSOs directly. He's comfortable with it. It will require that they get a light meter to read that stuff. Just another piece of equipment, not particularly expensive. But that's going to be added in the package. It goes back to council. Otherwise, you know, just some additional tools. You know, as they do this work, we do have, you know, some resources we can direct folks to if they are having a difficult time affording the maintenance. You know, oftentimes buildings being not being maintained because the individuals living there have a difficult time maintaining it. Either they physically can't do the work or they can't afford to hire a contractor. CSOs have some resources that you can direct folks to, you know, in terms of, you know, our objective is to keep people in homes, but also keep homes from deteriorating to the point where they can no longer be lived in. You know, so you know, that's part of the deal here too.
Will this include rental properties, commercial properties?
Commercials too, yeah. Yeah, and there's actually some new language in here that deals with buildings that are boarded up so that our CSOs can actually deal with that if somebody's leaving a building boarded up for an extended period of time. You know, we put 90 days in there, and that, you know, kind of mirrors an approach Medford took, which, you know, they had a situation where they had a lot of buildings that were getting boarded up, and then the owners were not doing anything about it. And it became a drag on those neighborhoods because it just became an attractive nuisance. And, you know, I don't know, 90 days is perfect. Council seemed comfortable with that, recognizing that, again, this is, you know, a circumstance that after 90 days, the CSOs would engage, and then there would be another, you know, a schedule for getting it remedied. So, you know, and that may vary depending upon some of the circumstances. Maybe somebody's like, you know, I am working on it, but, you know, the contractor I'm working with can't get to it till X date, blah, blah, blah.
On the exterior lighting, Derek, you may want to check. I think the Oregon Structural Specialty Code requires 1 foot candle for parking lots. So if you require no more than half, and oftentimes like a parking lot's going up to a property line, so.
I have the foot candle equivalency for those. So I'll take a look at it.
Yeah, because I think it's too low, right? It should be at least
now,
1 foot candle.
Tends to be on the, I'll look at that provision.
Yeah, I think most parking lots are designed for 1 foot candle, not half a foot candle.
Does this also include the boat on South Beach?
Probably not.
Well, it's in disrepair.
Boat's
well,
not, boat's not a building.
But he's working on it
so.
Once every 6 months.
They'll get that taken care of.
I also was wondering on graffiti, what does it mean when it says unauthorized painting, writing, or drawing? So how would you authorize it? I'm thinking of like murals. There's a lot of like houses in town that you drive around and they've got like artwork on the side.
Is it authorized by the person who owns the building where that was done? I mean, there's a difference between, you know, murals and you can get some rather creative murals. Part of the reason why that language was added in is the existing code just simply says that a property owner has to abate graffiti, but it makes no reference to, hey, by the way, you know, it's not appropriate for you to be graffitiing people's property in the first place. So, you know,
there's something weird
context,
about
context, probably more than anything else. The police department has other rules that they can lean on to deal with somebody who's graffitiing up private or public structures.
I wish Borrelia was here, but I feel like something about like which damages any real or personal property could be used to, like, from an attorney perspective to say, you know, you're damaging my property because I have to look at this mural.
We have murals under an entirely different code. So, I mean, murals covered under the sign code. Part of this is a consent issue.
Under motor vehicles, would that include things like travel trailers, things that have to be pulled that are not themselves mechanized, boat trailers?
It doesn't say that. Motorized.
Nope. Now there are other provisions, and we went through this with the council. There are a number of provisions that can be layered in terms of clutter and debris or inoperable equipment, things of that nature. You'll see are issues where those things can fall under. But inoperable motor vehicles means motorized, not bicycles, not trailers. Well, unmotorized trailers. and we got rid of junk. Junk is just a loaded term that we didn't really need in there. that's not what it was about. And one, you know, one person's treasure is another person's junk kind of deal. We don't need that.
You want feedback on very specific things here, or?
Sure, if you'd like, I'd be and happy to.
I think I'm on 040. Yeah, 040. C.
Okay. Most of this is. So you're 810.040. Is that where you're at? C.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's page 5 on the draft ordinance.
I'm sorry?
Page 5.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, okay. Just that, about halfway down that paragraph.
Yeah.
The lowercase I should be included in the strikeout, and it's not.
Oh, I see it over there. Yeah, I'll pick that up. Thank you.
I mean, I don't know if you want to go down to that level of detail, but... on I on that same section.
Oh, vermin?
Vermin.
Harborage of vermin.
Yeah, the... okay. They're only talking about the stuff to feed the vermin, or they're talking about the vermin itself?
Well, the only provisions added to I were that if you know basically outlines your corrective action. You know, if you have an issue with vermin, you need to eradicate them.
Right, but this in conjunction with the definition of vermin, which is elsewhere.
Right. That
implies that, you know, if I've got an empty lot and it's got a bunch of rats and mice on it, that I need to clean that up.
Yep.
Well, every empty lot in this town has a bunch of rats and mice on it. So,
you know, again, you know, I mean,
this is going to be, I assume, a complaint-based.
Complaint-based, and these are tools for code enforcement. You're usually not dealing with just one. In many cases, you're dealing with multiple provisions of the nuisance code that, you know, when they're dealing with. I think a more common one would be like a pile of debris on that property. Somebody just piling up debris on a property.
Right.
Maybe they say they own two lots, and one has the house and the other one has their pile of debris. And the debris is becoming an issue with rats in that area. Then code enforcement would address that under the nuisance code.
Okay, what's to keep me from complaining about Brannigan's backyard having
nothing,
having rats and mice?
Nothing. Code enforcement is going to have to decide whether or not it's no different than we have an individual who's an individual's complaining about peeled paint on because they have an issue with their neighbor, and the peeled paint's really not that significant, but they don't like their neighbor, and that's their way of venting on that.
Okay, you know? So it's just
code enforcement's just going to have to make judgment calls as to which ones they pursue or not.
Okay. I just thought maybe that thing could be more focused towards effect on a structure rather than just the general term.
Well, there's a lot of ways to improve the habitat for rodentia, and it doesn't have to be purposeful, but that's kind of, you know, what that officer hopefully will look at. Are they adding to the environment to lure more and support more, or is this just a common population? I can see, you know, they're going to have to cut a few leaves here and figure that out. So.
Okay, then farther on, 8.10.120.
That's over in the structural stuff. Yeah.
A1, I'm not sure 30 days is enough. By the time you round up a contractor and actually get to some work, I don't think 30 days is adequate. After a big windstorm, half the houses in town have holes in the roof. So I just would like to see that one maybe be a little longer.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to probably, that's a good catch. Thank you. I think what I'm probably just put in there is 90 days. It syncs up with the emergency provision.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. All right. So that's number one. On number 8, 9, I guess it's 10 now. Oh, the 4 didn't get struck out, but it's 10.
Yeah.
Any building or structure component attachment that is visibly broken or damaged. That again is seems to be awfully broad, but it's more of a discretion of the
yep.
CSO.
Yep.
I mean, Brannigan's got a dead, or used to have, no, Rikus had a dead dish network hanging from his chimney.
Yeah, he did.
It was ugly, rusting away. That would, but, you know, it didn't really insult me or anything. But so that's all going to be discretionary. We're
it
not
is.
Talking about a hole in a downspout being a reason to have the CSO come over.
No, but if you've got more serious gutter issues and it's leading to dry rot because the gutters aren't maintained and you know that I mean it's degrees of
yeah.
of this. Okay. So, but what this really has helped our CSOs because they've had a chance to review this stuff too is better understand what things they need to be looking at too. Or what specific elements they should be looking at, if, you know, whether or not to, you know, further advance the issue or not when they get a complaint.
Do you know the percentage of their work that's complaint driven versus
the bulk of it? But it's the bulk of it. But they will. I mean, if they see something that's particularly egregious, they'll respond to it.
Okay.
Most of it's. Well, a lot of it's vacation rental complaints, probably.
No, actually, you get a fair amount of month-to-month rentals, too, on building maintenance type of stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, probably more of them, because the vacation rentals tend to want to project a certain look.
Yeah, they're actually
I was talking about other vacation rental violations.
They're incentivized to be better maintained. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, short-term rental work is part of what the CSOs deal with. They deal with a lot of circumstances where you have broken down cars, you know, that are just parked and not moving. You know, they deal with lots of stuff.
Another thing I just thought about is like side stairs. So I know personally, like when we built our house, because my son's bedroom went out the lower level, we had to provide stairs back up to the public right away. And so Joseph had us add stairs. And then those stairs had to have 1 foot candle of illumination on them by code. And then the NFPA recommends 10 foot candles by code. But that's a recommendation, not a requirement.
Yeah, that's awfully
low. It's high. Yeah, that's the NFPA. But I do think it should be 1 foot candle because that's another area where I'm like, we had to provide 1 foot candle for those stairs. And those stairs are right on our side of our house, so it's on our property line.
One more thing, this has bugged me for a long time and it sort of ties to this item, 8.10.145, and to your, if you were willing, to your code cleanup, under 145 item B, it just never makes any sense. It never happens. We've talked about it before. You try to do it, the judge just says, no, I ain't going to do that. Now, maybe that's the function of that particular judge, but I've seen it in my personal complaint history.
Yeah.
And it just, it's in a lot of places under civil penalty, and it just is meaningless because it'll never get issued because mm-hmm. the judge would never respect it anyway.
I'll mention that to Jason, the police chief. I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you. I think that's all I had.
Okay. Last item on the agenda is an update on the work programs.
Just one minor change on there that had to do with the GEO. I'll add that in moving forward in terms of when I think we can get that back in front of you for a work session. That's about it right now.
Okay, that being said, the work session is now over. at 6:55. Thank you, everybody.